Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Jessica from Greenlight, and we are thrilled to host tonight's event with Maggie Shipstead, presenting her new book, Great Circle. She's going to be talking with Brandon Taylor, so you are in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Maggie, Brandon, and the team at Knopf for making this event happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces right now, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. And importantly, tonight's featured book, Great Circle, as well as several other books by these authors, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person in our bookstore locations 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase Maggie's book and many others on site. Or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Brandon Taylor. He's the author of the acclaimed novel Real Life, which has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, longlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, and named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. He holds graduate degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Iowa, where he was an Iowa Arts Fellow at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in Fiction. His story collection, Filthy Animals, is forthcoming from Riverhead Books on June 22, so just in a few short weeks, and you can find that book for pre-order on the event page. I'll let you know, I'll drop that in the chat in a moment as well. Brandon's going to be speaking tonight with our featured author, Maggie Shipstead. She is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Great Circle, Astonish Me, and Seating Arrangements, which won the Dylan Thomas Prize and the LA Times Prize for First Fiction. She's a graduate of Harvard and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. A frequent contributor to travel magazines, she's often away from her home in Los Angeles. Her new book, The Great Circle, tells the unforgettable story of a female aviator determined to chart her own course in life at any cost. Her life intersects with an actress playing her decades later and with other women charting their own courses in their own ways. It's epic and emotional. It's meticulously researched and gloriously told. As I was saying to the author just beforehand, I was hoping to hold up my own reading copy, but I loaned it to a friend because it's the kind of book that you just have to share with someone because it's so, so wonderful. So Maggie's going to start with a reading from the book, and then she'll be in conversation with Brandon and then take questions from all of you. So Maggie, please take it away.
Hello. Thanks everybody for coming to this virtual event. It's nice to not see you, but know you're out there. I know Great Circle recently came out and is very long, so I'll kind of operate on the assumption not everyone's read it. It is the story of a fictional pilot named Marion Graves, who disappears in 1950 while trying to fly around the world north-south over the poles. It sort of starts much earlier. It starts before her birth and goes through her life as she learns to fly in Montana in the 1920s. She flies in Alaska in the 30s. She flies during World War II, transporting warplanes in the UK. And it's intertwined with the story of a modern movie star named Hadley Baxter, who's playing Marion in a movie about her life and gets sort of sucked into the question of who she was and what happened to her. I'm just going to read a very short part. I'm going to read the very beginning. It only takes a few minutes, but we'll give you a little bit of the flavor of the voice. This is the final entry from The Sea, the Sky, the Birds Between, the lost logbook of Marion Graves, published by D. Wenceslas & Sons, New York, 1959. Little America 3, Ross Ice Shelf, Antarctica, March 4th, 1950. I was born to be a wanderer. I was shaped to the earth like a seabird to a wave. Some birds fly until they die. I have made a promise to myself. My last descent won't be the tumbling, helpless kind, but a sharp gannet plunge, a dive with intent, aimed at something deep in the sea. I'm about to depart. I will try to pull the circle up from below, bringing the end to meet the beginning. I wish the line were a smooth meridian, a perfect taut hoop, but our course was distorted by necessity, the indifferent distribution of islands and airfields, the plane's need for fuel. I don't regret anything, but I will if I let myself. I can think only about the plane, the wind, and the shore so far away, where land begins again. The weather is improving. We've fixed the leak as best we can. I will go soon. I hate the never-ending day. The sun circles me like a vulture. I want a respite of stars. Circles are wondrous because they're endless. Anything endless is wondrous, but endlessness is torture too. I knew the horizon could never be caught, but still chased it. What I have done is foolish. I had no choice but to do it. It isn't how I thought it would be now that the circle is almost closed, the beginning and end held apart by one last fearsome piece of water. I thought I would believe I'd seen the world, but there's too much of the world and too little of life. I thought I would believe I'd completed something, but now I doubt anything can be completed. I thought I would not be afraid. I thought I would become more than I am, but instead I know I am less than I thought. No one should ever read this. My life is my one possession. And yet, and yet, and yet.
Oh, that was so, oh my gosh, I love this book. I have so many questions. I think it is one of those books that just, I mean, the scope of it, the scale of it, just invite, there are a million things I want to ask. But I guess the place that makes the most sense to begin is with the beginning. And I'd love to hear a little bit about like the origin of the book, if it has an origin story and how you came to write it.
Sure. Yeah. It has a really specific partial origin. So I was traveling in New Zealand in the fall of 2012. And so my first book, Seating Arrangements, came out in June of 2012. So that was kind of out and had done its thing. And I had already sold Astonish Me. And so I was waiting for edits. So I was in this in-between moment where I knew I had a little bit of time. I was going to try and get started on another project. But the project I was planning to work on while I traveled just like died on me. It just was inert. And so I was at the airport in Auckland and was kind of feeling sorry for myself. And there's a statue there of this female pilot named Jean Batten, who was the first person to fly solo from England to New Zealand in 1936. It's a cool statue. And it had a quote from her that said, "I was destined to be a wanderer." And something just clicked and I was like, oh, I should write a book about a female pilot. And so I felt this certainty about that, but I didn't start working on it for another 2 years. Partly because Astonish Me came out and I was doing stuff for that and just busy. And then I moved to LA then. And so I kind of had my office, which I'm sitting in right now, and my stuff all in one place. And so I started working then with no real plan. I had a few things. I thought she would fly during World War II, but I hadn't decided whether it'd be in the US or the UK. And so I just kind of got going and I started at the beginning. So I think I wrote that section first, which was helpful kind of for setting the tone. And then for some reason got in my head that next should come this sort of ocean liner disaster. And so then had to start researching and that really became the pattern. And then it wasn't, I was probably a month in when I had the idea to include Hadley as well. But even with all of that, I really had no concept of what I was getting into. I was like, I'll be done with this in a year. No.
I mean, yeah. Wow. The idea of being done with this book, there are like 8 novels in this novel. I guess that leads to my next question, which is, you know, the novel has so many, you know, it has aviation history, it has ocean liner history, it has prohibition era things in it. And so there are the sort of like big ticket sort of feats of, you know, mechanical engineering that like changed the face of like human history. Like we could suddenly traverse these great distances. There are those parts of history in the book, but there are also these like really hyper specific detail, like period details of just like how people lived on a day-to-day basis in the book. And I'd love to hear a little bit about like your research that like went into this book, because I mean, it really is, you bring that period of history to life like whole cloth. And it's a real feat. And I just love to hear a little bit about the research that went into the book, because I mean, I feel like you found every rock there was to be turned over. You found it and kicked it over.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, my approach in general is so scattershot. So I think typically what happens is I'll be like, okay, like now I'm going to write this section that takes place in a house in Missoula in 1926 or whatever. And then I'm like, okay, like, would they have had electric lights? Like, would there be a bathroom? And so then I have to go down some rabbit hole trying to figure that out, you know? And usually I find the answer, or if I don't, I just lied over what I don't know. But then, you know, often in the process of chasing that sort of specific question, I come across something else where I'm like, well, that has to go in, you know, like there's this whole brothel sequence in Missoula in the 20s. And I think, that came from coming across some account in my research of how there had been a red light district and got cleaned out. And so all the sort of brothels went to these houses, the ones that were left. And, so it's this really sort of, yeah, accidental chain of events that seem to fuel the plot. But I have like this, you know, weird collection of like used books that I'd ordered to answer like one tiny question that may or may not have ended up in the story. And then other times I just tried to avoid super specific details. Like, I don't think I talk a lot about what people are wearing really. But one detail that I just thought of for some reason in the context of Missoula was I came across a mention of how there was a food delivery, like a restaurant delivery service. It was like Uber Eats in like the 30s in Missoula. And so this Marion, my character, is looking for jobs. And when I read about that, I was like, well, that's something she could do. Like, people would call, you know, a phone number and place their order and you'd bring them their food. So yeah.
I mean, Marion, like the first gig economy, like Marion, the first Uber Eats, right? I love that whole concept. I mean, and okay, so then one of the big themes of the book to me seems to be both Marion and Hadley are like women of their time having to negotiate the set of like mores that are like that society would like them to do, but they've got other plans, you know, ambitions. They've got a person to become, and to become that person, they've got to like negotiate the ice flows of like patriarchy and whatnot. And in some ways, like, you know, like I think there's a cynical kind of naive read of the book where it's like, well, Marion's having to do feminism back in the day and now Hadley's still having to do it. Like, what much has like changed for women and et cetera? And so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about writing, and it's not just Marion and Hadley, like you touch on so many different kinds of history, like the kinds of lives that are often distorted by the official archive. And you're writing about those people with a set of attitudes and language that we have accessible in our contemporary time, but you're making it feel contemporary to their time. None of this makes sense, but I'd love to hear you talk about that part of it, like writing about the kinds of people who the archive is very hostile to and excludes from a contemporary place while making it feel, you know, realistic to their time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so Marion has this kind of really feral, unsupervised childhood. And so I think just in her growing up years before she sort of has this epiphany that she has to be a pilot, it just doesn't really occur to her that her gender might be a limitation. And then when she sees how much harder it's going to make things, she sort of starts to see, you know, altering her appearance to be perceived as a boy or a man as sort of strategic in certain cases. And so then somehow in my research too, I came across this figure, this native person named Sitting in the Water Grizzly, who was born a girl, considered a girl, married a member of David Thompson's party, European Exploration Party, kind of vanishes from the historical record and then reappears in the writings of all these explorers like John Franklin, David Thompson, the historians, and now as a man married to a wife and sort of with this prophecy business. And it was so fascinating to me that here's this person that we would probably call transgender, two-spirit, and these Westerners, I think, or not Westerners, Europeans, sort of encountered him. And I think he was already so other just by being a native person that the transgender aspect of it sort of didn't faze them. They're just like, huh, sitting in the water grizzly's back and he's a man now. Like, that's cool. This must be like a local custom. And so Marion kind of has a bit of gender fluidity. She has queerness to her, but no vocabulary for it, as you said. So in some ways, she's not under any pressure to herself to define it. She just sort of follows her impulses and her need for freedom. And I thought that aspect was, you know, people of all stripes have always existed. There have always been queer people. There have always been trans people. And so I think, yeah, as you said, just being a little bit under the radar about it. But I was interested in, you know, her determination to lead an unorthodox life in any sense, you know, just not having her life be dominated by marriage and children, just took this constant vigilance and she had to defend it at all times. But it also allowed her lots of kinds of freedom, not just geographical freedom, but sexual freedom and an element of gender freedom. And then Hadley, you know, it's funny, I've gotten a lot of interview questions that are like, do you think things are harder for women now? And I'm like, no, like we can have credit cards. But, you know, Hadley, I think, is under this tremendous pressure by just the fact of her celebrity. And she can't, you know, be a woman the right way. You can't please everybody. And everybody is always mad at her. And so that's sort of the restriction on her freedom, in a sense. And she doesn't quite know what to do about it. I think, too, just it's, I didn't sit down and go like, oh, I'm going to write a feminist book, but being a woman and considering yourself as having free will is a feminist act. And that's, you know, Marion's kind of starting point.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I've been describing the book to myself is that it's kind of a feminist pastiche of those like late 19th century, like swashbuckling novels.
Totally.
That feel like incredibly American in some way. And I'm like, it's like those, but it's feminist. It's like a feminist pastiche of, like, you know, the Ivanhoe and the we're gonna go out west and make a future for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that feels right.
I mean so speaking of swashbuckling, like Marion feels like one of those like quintessential like classic American characters. Like, she gets into so much trouble and it is like delightful to follow her as she completes these acts of daring do. The section where she's learning to fly planes is just like one of the most arresting pieces of writing I've ever read. I guess like my question from like a craft and an envious writer place is like, how do you get your character into scrapes where they have to discover something about themselves? And what was it like to write those scenes where she's like maybe gonna die, maybe not gonna die, but all she knows is that she has to fly?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I haven't had a moment where I was like, I'm about to die. I don't think I've been that close, but I started travel writing kind of while I was writing this book and did a lot of polar stuff and kind of made that my specialty. I started to have some scrapes, like things go wrong, but really encountering people who are really comfortable with risk and live with a level of risk that I wouldn't really be able to endure. So I sort of tried to internalize people and personalities like that. I certainly read a lot of kind of nonfiction, particular adventure-y stuff, memoirs. I read books by pilots and about pilots. And I'm really curious about that sort of psychology of, you know, pilots at the time were just so likely to die, like in the 20s. There's, you know, they all knew lots of people who had died flying, and they all sort of would say, well, I accept the risk. And I've always wondered, there's no way to know, you know, but in the seconds before a fatal crash, like, do you still feel that way? Like, does that feeling last to the end? And it's impossible to know if that sort of algebra is something you can access in an extreme state. And so I think I was kind of exploring that a little bit with those sequences too.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways the book feels like it's in conversation with this the concept of like the vanished woman, like that's very much like a cultural like force in the world in which we live. But where this feels different is that it is a woman who has gone missing, who has vanished, but somehow like it's the result of a series of choices she made. It wasn't just someone acting upon her in like a really harrowing, sinister way. It's like she accepts the risk. It's the outcome of risk. And I think it's the kind of thing that we're more accustomed to seeing, like with dudes, like climbing, daredevil-y. What was it like to sort of interrogate the idea of like relitigate the concept of the daredevil, and to do that within, you know, this awareness that like you're working in like the tradition of like the missing, vanished, mysterious woman who has disappeared under mysterious circumstances?
It was the husband. I mean, I thought about a lot of different things. Like Amelia Earhart was definitely in the sort of primordial soup of this. But what interested me the most about her from the, and you know, when I was writing and I'd say what the book was about, people would be like, ooh, like Amelia Earhart. And like, you know, fair enough. But, and I always be like, no, not like Amelia Earhart. You know, what interests me about her the most, I think, is that it's actually like almost impossible that anything happened other than she ran out of fuel, she crashed in the ocean and died. Like I could go on and on about why, but it's just like any other lands way too far away. It's crazy. Like, you know, every once in a while something surfaces in the media where they're like, this is a photograph of Amelia Earhart. And it's like just the back of like what looks like a dark haired man on a dock. And you're like, what? Like, why do you think that? But it goes viral. And then what never goes viral is the correction that in fact that photo was taken years before her flight. And people are so hungry to believe something other than kind of the grim truth, you know, and this search for what really happened is actually just a search for like red herrings to make it seem like something happened, which I find really perverse and strange and like sometimes really irritating. But I was like, why is it that we think about it? So like, why is disappearance different from death? Like, especially when it's kind of clearly the same thing. So that was one of my starting points. And I always want to write, I keep wanting to write an essay called What We Talk About When We Talk About Amelia Earhart.
Please. But
as yet have not. But the other thing was, I don't know if my agent's on this. I always tell this story and then she's like, I was there. But kind of after my first draft, so it took me 3 years and 3 months to write the first draft. And then she took sort of 3 weeks or a month to read it. And then we had this series of like hours long conversations about it. And she was kind of like, I don't understand why anyone would do this. Like, why would anyone fly around the world north, south? And I was like, to me, it seems abundantly clear, but I just couldn't begin to articulate it. And the best articulation I found was in a book called The Ice Bloom by Alec Wilkinson. And it's like about a failed hot air balloon expedition to the North Pole at the very beginning of the 20th century that shockingly doesn't work. And he sort of says, you know, these early explorers would just have a vision of themselves doing one of these things. And the obscurity of the vision was persuasive to them. Like the fact that there was no real reason was part of what drove them. And that really resonated with me. And that's kind of what I started to bring to the book too. But yeah, I don't know, my relationship to the sort of quote unquote mystery of it was constantly evolving.
But I feel like that's how you know you've got something live on the other end, is when your relationship to the sort of like imponderables or the inarticulable mystery of it is like constantly some days you've got it figured out and other days you're like, who even knows, like what is the world?
Just starting from questions, not answers, you know. So people are like, well, what did you want to say with this? And it's like, no, nothing, I was just trying to figure something out, maybe, which I didn't. So
yeah, you're like trying to do a thing, like give me some room. I guess, okay, so switching gears from like Marion's sort of daring do to Hadley's like near me to Hollywood thing. I mean, one of the things that animates the Hadley section, so this contemporary movie star in Hollywood, some of the things that animate that are like all these like really cleverly done references to things that seem almost, I'm like, is it? But who? That like chase the shadows.
Like blind items.
Yes, I love them so much. and I won't ask you to implicate yourself by naming names, but I would love to know a little bit about what were some of like the most fun blind items to include, like the sort of got, because like the Hadley sections are incredibly incisive, like the Foucault bit when she's like in Intro to Philosophy and she's like, you don't know what it's like to be famous, I'm in the Panopticon. All of that writing was incisive and wonderful, but the Hadley sections also have this kind of like dishy insidery vibe to them. And so I'd love to hear about like what were some of the most fun blind items to include, and also like how do you go about like writing about contemporary LA and Hollywood in a way that isn't just like boring to you? Because I'm like a part, like some of it seems like very, you know, it seems like it could be boring, but it manages to be dishy and insidery, and I wanted to know everything.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood's funny that way because to, you know, a great extent, and most of my friends in LA work in the business in one way or another. I mean, I think a lot of it is just mundane, like, workaday stuff. It's people doing their jobs and making phone calls and stuff. But then I think also the sort of wildness of it is true. And so part of, I had written a short story that was in Tin House in like, I don't know, 2014, 2013. That's actually, I have a collection coming out next summer and it's the title story. It's called You Have a Friend in 10A.
Oh my God. You've heard it here, folks.
And it was kind of a it was like a sort of Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise story with this sort of glossed over Scientology. And it was in this really intense first person voice that's a bit different from Hadley's. But I was, like a month into writing the Marion story. And then I wrote this section where Hadley leaves a nightclub with sort of a John Mayer figure, if you will, publicly cheating on her co-star and boyfriend who's in this sort of, yeah, like Twilight-esque YA romance series. And she kind of just blows up a scandal semi on purpose or on purpose. And it sort of had no clear connection to Marion, but I just knew this was the missing piece. Like I wanted this like different tone that could cut through all this historical fiction. I wanted a lens to get at, you know, how much of a life gets lost, especially over this much time. And so I just knew it was the component. And when I wrote the story in Tin House, I liked the fact that I was starting with something that was kind of would be semi-familiar to most readers, which is sort of like, you know, playing with dynamite a little bit with cliche, because using something that's familiar, you're like, you know, are you retreading something, you know, tired? And it's sort of like, maybe, but I also wasn't looking to sort of write a really gritty, kind of fresh take on Hollywood. I wanted to play with what was known. And so one of those things is this sort of, as you said, like Me Too incident with a producer and sort of a casting couch moment. And I think I wrote it before the Harvey Weinstein news broke. But what I think about that is that, you know, the Harvey Weinstein news was both a hard-won journalistic bombshell and surprising to no one. Yeah. You know, like even people have no connection to the movie business, like knew this guy was a predator. And so, yeah, I always feel like, you know, casting couch jokes have existed forever for a reason, or like altar boy jokes have existed forever for a reason, these things. So I kind of wanted to take those ingredients and just play with them and use it as an excuse to have a stronger sort of, or more distinctive style and more intense style in these shorter sections. So yeah, I mean, she's obviously, there's a bit of Kristen Stewart in her. I'm trying to think what other blind items are in there.
Well, there was someone who I took a picture and sent it to a friend where it was like the young actor who's like married to someone who's like twice his age, he met as a teenager. And I was like, oh my God. You know, and like certain passing resemblances to like recent streaming smash success runaway YA adaptations. And had a great time sort of picking them out. Like it felt they felt like Easter eggs to the overly to the much too online consumers of literature of the world.
Yeah, I had a really funny conversation about it with Curtis Sittenfeld actually in one of these things. And because of course she's written novels about Laura Bush and Hillary Clinton. And so she has deep experience and sort of taking the familiar. And the way she phrased it, which I really liked, was she was like, you know, if you're talking to a friend and you're describing someone you know, but they don't know, it's a really different conversation than if you're talking about someone you both know. And she was like, this kind of fiction, you're talking about someone you both know. And I was like, yeah, that's right. Like you just have a little sort of head start or something. And so it's a different kind of creation, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also interesting. I mean, one of the things that the book does so brilliantly is that, you know, it takes these two women from like drastically different, you know, moments in history. But if you really think about it, like Marion was kind of a bit of a child star. Like she was like kind of a child prodigy, and Hadley also being like a child prodigy. And like Hadley sort of notes the similarities as she's sort of getting familiar with the role and with who Marion is. But these two young women who are just like on fire with ambition, who have been told that their life should be one way, and who have a drastically different take on the received ideas of their time. And so I guess my question is like, because both of those sections, I mean, and it's not like you do one huge tract of Marion and then like the second half of the novel is something else. I mean, it's like truly like deeply intermeshed and interwoven, and their voices are so distinct and so different. And like the style of the writing changes, even like Marion's sections are these incredibly sweeping lyrical like passages. And then like Hadley's are like these like sharp, incisive, like telegraphic first person sections. But I guess my question is like, how do you as a writer like marry those two things? How do you bring those two distinct set of registers together like within one book and to do it so seamlessly and effortlessly? I mean, it feels impossible.
Oh, yeah, it kind of was. I didn't have a ton of trouble switching between the voices, although when I would return to a Hadley section or write a new one, I'd have to go back and read the old Hadley sections to kind of like recalibrate. Although I did find that her voice was sort of strongest in the earlier ones. And then as I became doing more work with her sort of plot line and connecting her to Marion, like the voiciness of it dropped off a little bit, which was probably fine. And I would then go and kind of punch it up in revision. But the structure of how to balance them was really... that might have been kind of the last thing to fall in place with my edits. We're always kind of like reshuffling and reproportioning them. Because, you know, it was like not too much Hadley, but not too little Hadley. I took a couple different approaches to her in my drafts. There was one version, I think pretty early on, where she and Redwood, the movie producer, are like in a library, like digging through boxes of like stuff on Marion and like more sort of literally addressing this question of who Marion was. And I wanted to sort of, yeah, lock them together. And so I did include these sort of factual connections. Like they're both raised by these sort of dissolute uncles, and Hadley's parents died in a small plane crash. And some of it was just for fun novel spookiness, you know, but also to give Hadley a reason to look at Marion as she does, as sort of like tea leaves or tarot cards or something. Like she's looking at this other life being like, what does this mean for me? Because Hadley is not self-absorbed. And yeah, they just kind of, I've talked a lot about Scrivener. Do you use Scrivener?
I don't, though I know all about, I mean, I feel like this is the kind of book that Scrivener was made for. I feel like
it would have been impossible. Like I had downloaded Scrivener like the day before I started writing it. And then I was like, aha, like, but I also think it like is part of the reason why it became this sort of like sprawling thing. Like it just wouldn't have been feasible for me on Word. And so with Scrivener, I could, you know, see where all the chapters were and sort of even just visually move Hadley and place her throughout them. But It was really, I think the last stuff I probably actually wrote from scratch was kind of the end of Hadley's arc, just trying to fit it in with Marion in a way that was satisfying, but not too cute. You know, that's always the, with dual narratives, I think that's one of the big pitfalls. So yeah, it was hard. It was hard to sort of, or it was impossible to hold it all in my head. I was always having to go back and read, and every draft, you know, I'd find like weird loose threads and things. And I had also initially conceived of the flight sections, which are now all together kind of at the end of the book, as being interstitial. And so at least the first draft, maybe the first two, had also had these, it'd be like, you know, Svalbard when you're on page 300. And it was just kind of one too many things for the reader to juggle. And I thought it would be boring when they're all put together, but hopefully it's not. It has a little bit more urgency, I think.
No, I mean, no, there's nothing boring. there are no boring parts. Even the parts where you're going from like geological history, like into the, I'm like, yes, tell me everything about this glacier. Tell me everything about these mountains and how they came to be. I cannot get it out.
Some of that stuff did get trimmed. When I sold it, which was like 2 years and 8 months ago, it was 980 pages long, the manuscript. So it was almost 300,000 words. And this, you know, typeset is under 600, but manuscript would still be about 750. But that, you know, the loss of length was mostly small pervasive cuts. And that was the advantage of a book this long, is if you cut a little bit on every page, it added up to be a lot of pages. But I used to have this whole like tangent, like in the sections you're describing, the incomplete histories, I had this thing that was about like the discovery of the coelacanth, you know, that prehistoric fish that people thought was extinct. And then like at the same time as nuclear fission was being discovered, it had nothing to do with anything. And people were like, could you take it down like two notches?
Okay, but like, I would like that. Please put it into the director's. I guess this leads to my last question. Everyone send in your questions to the Q&A box, but what were some of your favorite bits that got left on the cutting room floor? Because I imagine there must have been so much that you wanted to put in or could have put in and then maybe did and then had to take out.
Yeah, I mean, there was just sort of more of everything. Like everything was longer, like the section that's sort of the history of flight, sort of cobbled together with Marion's history over these few years in the 30s. There was more of that. There was a freestanding incomplete history of Antarctica, which also went back to like Pangaea and through the explorers. But that came, you know, right at the end, and my editor very rightly was like, you know, people have read like 500 pages at this point. Like they might not want to be like 60 million years ago. And I used to have a plot line for Jamie, who is Marion's brother, for those who haven't read. And he went to live in this sort of radically pacifist religious community in Canada. This is real. They're called Dukobors. They're sort of like Russian Quakers. That was also determined to be one weird thing too many.
For Jamie. Oh my
gosh. It was bananas. Like there's just, I don't know. And you know, the whole process where I was just working on it by myself. Like so my agent read it after 3 years. Which is just like, I don't know, the writer equivalent of like emerging with like Howard Hughes fingernails, mm-hmm. like wearing Kleenex boxes on your feet. I was just like, what do you think of this? You know, and she was like, we might need to trim this. So it's been an adventure. I don't want to do it again.
Oh yeah. Well, I would like, please release these as like standalone things. Your fans, me, I am the fans, would love to read about the coelacanth and nuclear fission. Please, we need it. Okay, so hopping over to the Q&A box, Beth would like to know, do you see that there are any threads that run through your three books?
Ooh, great question. Yeah, I mean, I think, so it was maybe more obvious in my first two books. My first book was about a waspy wedding on a fictionalized Nantucket. And it was more sort of satirical and kind of prickly than either of these books, although Hadley has roots there. And then Astonishment is this Cold War ballet drama. I think, you know, as a writer, like, one thing I like about writing novels is that it is a chance to sort of investigate a new world and go deep into it. And so I think with all my books, I've used them as excuses to learn more about something. I'm not very persuaded by write what you know. Like, I think you're capable of learning. You can find out more things and know about more things. So that's what I try to do. So yeah, I think an interest in sort of strongly defined kind of microcosms. And I think the first two books are both apparent in this book in a way that they maybe don't relate to each other quite as strongly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Yeah. I mean, plus, listen, if you were to write an entire historical novel about Marion's mom and, like, the terrible Waspy family, please. Annabelle, right? That's her name? Annabelle?
Yeah, yeah.
I would, the Annabelle Chronicles and the Pfeiffer Chronicles, please. I would love to read it.
My agent and I have this joke, you know, so Barclay, who's this bootlegger, he has sort of a henchman named Sadler, who in my first draft had just like an ever so slightly larger role, which for some reason enraged Rebecca. So he's become this through, like this necklace I'm wearing, she sent me, and engraved on it in tiny letters, it says Sadler. And like, I made her a tote bag of the book and it says Team Sadler. And so it's just like, there are all these offshoots. I keep telling her I'm going to write the Detective Sadler mysteries.
I mean, he was very henchman-like, but I really liked, I mean, that's one of the great things about this book is that all the characters, I'm just like, I could read another 1,000 pages about all of these people. It is a book that contains multitudes. Here we go. Here's a great one from Emily. Love the book. Did you know the ending when you began writing the book, or did it come to you at some point during the process?
I did not know the ending, and I won't reveal it. but I really hadn't decided how it would end until quite late, until like really when I had to figure it out. Which I think was a little unnerving for me as I wrote, because, you know, what are you sort of aiming toward is always the question, especially for someone like myself who can't plan or outline. I do need something to kind of aim for. But on the other hand, I think in some ways that meant that the ending is not inherent throughout the book. And so I think there are advantages to that as well.
Yeah, it doesn't feel overly determined at all. It's just right. But also I imagine like writing like a 900 page book without ending that does sound uniquely terrifying, Maggie. Well,
the worst day was like maybe 2 years in, and I knew she would fly in World War II. That was like something I was aiming toward. And so I realized I'd been writing for 2 years. I'd written more than 400 pages. I'd written longer than the seating arrangements. And I wasn't halfway done. I just knew I wasn't halfway done. And I was like, oh my God, you know, and of course, like friends of mine were publishing books and I was like, everyone will forget about me. But like, everyone forgets about you instantly. It doesn't matter. Like, hello, you're a novelist. Mm-hmm. But I just like, I couldn't, after that, I really couldn't let myself think about the whole. I just had to kind of trudge forward with my head down and do what I could in each day. And like the real hard part of the whole thing, I think, was just the stamina involved. And even the disheartening quality of like a book that long, you change one little thing and the ripple effect is enormous. You know, you have to go through 700 pages and like rejigger everything. And so that was rough. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's, yeah. Alex would like to know, aside from seeing the statue, did any of your experiences in New Zealand help inform Great Circle?
Yeah, for sure. Some of my formative flying experiences were in New Zealand. This was kind of right when I was getting started. And so I went on, it was the first time I landed in a plane on glacier and snow. The only time I've controlled a plane was in New Zealand. It was a glider. And the pilot was sitting behind me, and he was like, all right, like, make a turn. And so I started to turn. I was just like, I do not like this. And I'd sort of thought, you know, should I take flying lessons? And I'm sure I would have gained a lot from it, but I just fundamentally did not want to. Mm-hmm. So that was clarifying. I have been to the New Zealand subantarctic, which figures in a little bit. And yeah, it was also one of the first times I really traveled alone and kind of sought out more adventure-y type things. So yeah, it was kind of an important place for the book.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like New Zealand is sort of the heartstone of this book in some ways. I know,
in ways. Yeah, it's funny.
Here's one from Halima, who is just the best.
Halima.
I would love to hear you talk about more about Barkley and how you calibrated his character, balancing his charisma with his completely reprehensible nature, which is almost a dawning realization, even if it should be obvious to everyone it's not totally at first. I mean, I agree. I was deeply under his spell. I was enraptured. And then when he reveals his true nature, I thought, oh no.
But you're so sexy. Yeah, I think again this kind of partly comes from just not planning. So when I first had him appear, and kind of right when Marion needed him, I hadn't really thought through the whole arc. And so then I needed someone who would be intriguing to her. You know, even as a teenager, she's not out there like looking for a boyfriend necessarily. And he's captivated by her and fascinated by her by reasons he doesn't fully understand. And even that, the like lack of understanding, is something that intrigues her and kind of goes back to this whole like, why would you fly around the world question. And then I just saw their sort of personal projects with each other or for their relationship as being completely incompatible. You know, he wants to sort of possess her, and then he wants her to lead a different kind of life than she wants to lead, a more domestic life, where she just wants to fly, and these things cannot be reconciled. And so he starts, you know, devolving. I'm not sure he was such a bad person until he couldn't get what he wanted, and then he starts to become a much more oppressive figure in her life. So yeah, that's kind of how it came about. But I feel like I never, like, even though he does behave horribly in the book, I never really like hated this character. I don't know. I don't think I've written a character I really hated. Have you? Do you write characters you hate?
No, I mean, it's a real problem. I mean, I write characters that other people hate, but I, because part of it is just like, in order for me to like write a character, I have to like be able to sit on their side of the table, even if they are doing something bad. I feel like I have to be able to give them the benefit of their convictions.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just like, I think D.H. Lawrence says something like, with moral fiction, like fiction that is immoral is fiction that has its finger on the scale, like you're cheating, like you're sort of like overly tipping the scale either pro or against a character. And so I'm always trying to make sure that my hands are off the scale. I'm just like letting the chips lie where they fall.
Totally. Yeah. And I remember it being a little bit of a shock, like when Seating Arrangements came out, because people would be like, oh, like they're so unlikable. And I was like, I just never thought of them in those terms. And also like, what do you mean? Like, why don't you like them?
They are prickly though. They're so waspy and it's perfection. Yeah. I'm with you. Team not liking or disliking characters. Characters are just characters. Here's a question. This book features so many unique locations around the world. One of the best things about it, I agree. How did you choose which places to include? Were there any specific locations that you didn't know much about before researching that you fell in love with during the process of writing?
Oh, that's such a nice question. So part of like one of the earliest things I did was try to figure out how you would fly around the world north, south in 1950, which would have been sort of borderline impossible. And the big problem was Antarctica, which at that point had no permanent bases. And with this airplane, really any other, you would need to refuel twice. So I kind of set about creating like feasibility. And so I timed Marion's flight with an expedition to East Antarctica at the time, and then used these existing kind of abandoned bases on the other side. But my brother, so I'm not a pilot, but my brother is just retiring from the Air Force after 20 years, and he hasn't flown in a while, but he used to fly a C-130, which is a four-propeller cargo plane. And so he and I sat with like a globe, and I was like, if you were going to do it, how would you do it? And it was like, well, you probably want to avoid Russia, which takes up a huge chunk of the planet, you know, just in this era and sort of the immediate post-war era. And a lot of the planet is ocean. Like if you look at the globe, they're just really limited places. So that was one of the first things I decided was where she would go. And there's a map in the beginning of the book, and I've been to almost all the places. So yeah, let's see. Starts in New Zealand, Hawaii, Alaska, Svalbard. That was actually the first place I went in the Arctic, by happenstance. And then down. So yeah, I would pitch travel stories to places where I wanted or needed to go. And I haven't been to the actual poles, but I've been to about 80 degrees north and 80 degrees south. And then places where I think I had a free layover in the Cook Islands, and the Cook Islands sort of happens to be on this line of longitude. So it's like, you know, in they go, like I already know what it looks like. I have pictures. And I'm also like a firm believer, you don't have to go to everywhere you write about. Like I've written about places I haven't been, and there are a couple examples of that in the book. But places, yeah, I mean, I feel like, I learned a lot more about the Aleutian Islands in Alaska for the book, which I have not been there. They are quite difficult to go to, but there's a wartime sequence there. My dog is like snorting and itching his body on my couch. Oh my gosh.
That's so relatable. What a relatable icon.
But yeah, the places, the Arctic and the Antarctic were kind of places I already knew I would love, because I love an empty, desolate landscape. And then in the process of going there, it has really shifted my just whole concept of the planet, really.
Yeah. Oh, incredible. I mean that is one of the things that gives the book such a sense of breadth, is that it happens in so many different places. And what I find is that sort of unites all of it is that it's always like a character who like is in a place that they feel both like a part of, but like there's like this calling to be somewhere else. Like all the characters in the book are almost like called by this preternatural force. Like when Marion's father gets out of prison, one of the first things he asks is like, can I go to the ocean? Can we go swim somewhere? I need to be in like a body of water. You know what I mean? It's the characters are always sort of like in transit somewhere, waiting for their real life to begin. And it's incredible.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm always like, the pandemic has put a bit of a wrinkle on this, but I am always like plotting like when I can get back to these places. And the poles in particular seem to really speak to people or not. Like I've done a lot of, you know, when I've done these travel magazine stories or been on, you know, Arctic or Antarctic cruises, there are a lot of couples, and often one of them is like hardcore into the poles and the other is just along because their weird partner, you know, has insisted they go. And it's funny, just the sort of binary of it that seems to exist.
I kind of love, that's incredible. I mean, please, right. Let that be one of the director's pet things, you telling us all about the weird couples of the poles. I guess maybe this will be the last question. In the age of Twitter, were there any concerns about the length of the book you had in your hands? And I guess I'd like to adjust that question a little bit, if I may be so bold. I mean, it feels like there are particular challenges to writing a long book, and then there are another set of challenges to publishing.
Yeah.
The anxiety, you know, like the anxieties of like publishing a long book. And could you tell us a little bit about how you dealt with that, negotiated that, worked through that, et cetera?
Yeah. Gus is being a total maniac right now, by the way.
Yeah. That's why. Yeah.
I mean, some of what was tied up in that moment of just like deep panic I was describing when I was 2 years in, where it's like, The only way out was through. Mm-hmm. I was searching for some way I could make it shorter, but like once you've committed to kind of your set granularity, it's mm-hmm. really hard to be like, okay, now Marion's 30 and don't worry about it. You know, like I just kind of had set the pace by then. You know, I had a lot of moments of profound doubt, but I think also I just fundamentally believed in the project and believed it would be worthwhile. And some of it was that there aren't a ton of long books. Like, I think not everyone, but Gus in the background, like plenty of people like long books and I do. And so when I was far enough into it to feel like it had structure and it would hold itself up, I thought, well, I'm just going to go big or go home, you know, mm-hmm. basically. But then, you know, when we went to, so Rebecca read it after 3 years and change, and then sort of a 9-month, 10-month process where I did another draft and then we sold it. And when we went to sell it, we sold it on a 500-page partial. So we just like didn't tell my editor how much more there was. She was like, how long is it? We were like, don't worry about it. Like, you don't need to know. But it did dawn on me just like, you know, I've gambled years of my life on one project and it's unusual. And I don't know for sure if anyone will publish it or like it or read it or whatever. And I also definitely plenty of people felt pretty comfortable expressing that doubt to me along the way, particularly because I am a woman. It'd be like, well, there aren't that many long books by women, are there? And it's like, well, there certainly are plenty of notable examples, but just like the assumption is that someone said like, will they even let you? And I was like, who's they? Like, but also I don't know, will they? There's only one way to find out. So but fortunately, you know, my editor, Jordan Pavlin, is my editor I've worked with on my other two books. And I've said this about her before, but I think, you know, some people define their taste by excluding things. And Jordan certainly has particular taste, but she also has this radical inclusivity. She's into all kinds of different stuff. And she also fortunately loves really long Russian novels. So, you know, she was totally open to it. I mean, she was like, we're gonna have to cut it down. And I was like, no, no, no. And I was protective of its length by the time it was done too. I did want to sort of do the assertive thing of writing a book this long. And it's been funny. There've been plenty of reviews, especially in the UK, that are very much like, do we think it's okay to write books this long? Like, we don't know, you know, and it's just like, there are all kinds of different books. There can be long books, but yeah, it's always been a big thing that gets talked about and a big part of what this book is the length and the scope.
I mean, but it feels so, the scope of it is one of the magical things about it. Like, you just, sometimes you need one of those perfect books just to vanish inside of for, you know, days. It's its own world. And I loved it for that.
That's what I crave. I know. I think a lot about, I don't really think about like readers, but I think a lot about the reading, like what I would want to read. And I like to read, yeah, big immersive books. So,
yeah. Well, you nailed this one. It's
brilliant. Oh, thank you. That's so kind.
Is it time for me to jump back on and say thanks?
So.
And what a huge fan I am of both of you. And to remind everyone that there's a link in the chat and you can buy Great Circle. You can pre-order Filthy Animals. I can attest as a reader that this book does not feel too long. It was barely long enough. Clearly, there's a lot of interest in the director's cut. I don't know if you've seen the chat, but like there's going to be discussion about that. But thank you so much, Maggie and Brandon, for being here. We appreciate you both so much. And congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, Jessica. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.